Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about the program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Visit our archives there and listen to any program you may have missed. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. We will repeat this info at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. And now, Jim Andrews.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We're in chapter 14. The narrative of the famous woman of Tekoa, the wise woman who helped David see things concerning Absalom from a little different perspective. But before we get into that, again, I invite you to obtain a digital copy of my revised and updated book, Polishing God's Monuments. You can go to my new website, jim-andrews.org. Don't forget that little dash, jim-andrews.org. Now, we return to the narrative. Joab imported a wise woman from Tekoa on the pretense of appealing to David about a personal problem that had remarkable analogies to the same problem that David had. David had his son Absalom, and Absalom was in exile. Absalom, David's heart went out to, and he wanted to bring him back. Problem was, the royal family did not want Absalom back. They felt he was a fugitive who needed to be apprehended and be executed for his murder of Amnon, the son of David who had raped Tamar. They considered him a dangerous figure. So the woman approached him with an analogous situation. When the king wanted to know what her problem was, she said, "I'm a widow. My husband is dead. Here's the deal. I had two sons. They got in a fight out in a field. There was nobody there to separate them. One struck the other and killed him. Now the whole family is up in arms against me," she said to David. "They're insisting that I hand over the one who struck his brother. They want to put him to death for the life of the brother whom he killed." You can see the analogy. They want to destroy the heir, because now Absalom is the next in line of succession. "If they do that, they will extinguish my coal which is left. My husband will be left with neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth." Well, the king said to the woman, "You go home. I'll make a decision later." She was very persistent. She said to the king, "Oh, my lord, the iniquity is on me and on my father's house, but the king and his throne are guiltless in this matter, whatever happens." The king says, "If anybody gives you trouble," verse 10, "you bring him to me. I'll see that he doesn't touch you anymore." She said, "Please let the king remember the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood may not continue to destroy, lest they destroy my son." And David reassured her, "As the Lord lives, not one hair of your son's head shall fall to the ground." The woman again said, "Please let your maidservant speak a word to my king." And he said, "Speak." And now she translated the whole analogy in terms of David's situation. "Why have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one who is guilty. I say that because the king does not bring back his banished one. And we, the people of God, shall surely die. We'll be like water spilled upon the ground, because it'll be the end of the dynasty, cannot be gathered up again. Yet God is merciful. He does not take away life, but he plans ways so the banished one may not be cast out from him. Now the reason I came to speak this word to my lord the king is because the people have made me afraid. So your maidservant said, 'Let me now speak to the king, because the king will perform the request of his maidservant. The king will hear and deliver his maidservant from the hand of the man who would destroy both me and my son from the inheritance of the Lord.' Then your maidservant said, 'Please let the word of the Lord, the king, be comforting, for you're like the angel of God, a messenger of God. So my lord, the king, will discern good and evil, and may the Lord your God be with you.'" Well, the king, by this time, he picks up on the deal. He knows the hand of Joab has been behind this, and he asks, "Is the hand of Joab with you in all this?" She answered, "Well, you got me there. he is behind it. In order to change the appearance of things, your servant Joab has done this thing. But my Lord is wise, like the wisdom of an angel of God to know all that is in the earth. The king said to Joab, behold now, I will surely do this thing. I see. Now go therefore and bring back the young man Absalom, which Joab proceeded to do. In verse 13, this woman begins to connect the dots for the king in relating her plight to his own situation with regard to Absalom. She points out to David the inconsistency between David's willingness to intervene to spare her son and heir from those who were intent on destroying her son, and David's so far unwillingness to show the same mercy to his fugitive son and presumptive heir, Absalom, and in doing so thus protect the inheritance of the whole nation, because Absalom, as I say, was the presumptive heir now. So she says, unless the king steps up with his royal authority and brings back his banished one, Absalom, we the people of the Lord, we shall surely die as a nation, and will be like water spilled out on the ground which cannot be gathered up again. In short, she viewed Absalom as the glue of the kingdom. His continued banishment would be imperiling David's young dynasty. To leave him hanging out there would expose the nation at David's passing to political chaos and potential extermination, convulsion through weakness. Now, of course, this woman had no way of knowing at the time that God has other plans. She had no way of knowing that Solomon was God's appointed heir. But from where they all stood at the moment, Absalom looked like the guy. And this situation, as we mentioned, is a good reminder. If we may put it so, folks, God always has his bases covered. Things were not so tenuous as Joab and she imagined. Joab, of course, had some vested interest in Absalom. The two were on very friendly terms, and Joab, in his bloody ways, especially with regard to the wanton murder of Abner, Saul's senior general, he still had a bill to pay, and he knew it was out there. So doubtless he figured to escape justice, payday someday, if he could facilitate the reinstatement of Absalom as heir, if he could get Absalom brought back from exile, because that way Absalom would be indebted to Joab forever. We should always do our due diligence, but we should never panic. We don't have to prop God's promises up with panic patches. Now, in what this woman says, she makes two theological points in her address to David as she translates the parable, the analogy between her situation and David's. On the face of it, they seem as though they're putting God in a position of causing an action and working to counteract it at the same time. What we have here is a paradox, not a contradiction. Let me explain. First, she notes, we shall all die. We'll be like water spilled out on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Well, indeed, we shall all pass from this life, I was saying as the last program ended. That's the penalty of human sin, imposed by God as a result of Adam's rebellion. No question, God does punish sin and mete out justice. However, she notes that is not the whole story with regard to God's moral nature. Yes, he's a just God who punishes sin, but God is also a merciful and compassionate God who plans his ways, like, for example, in the atoning death of Christ, so that the banished one, those banished from his holy presence through sin, might not be cast out from him. God is absolutely just, yet our just God is so merciful that without compromising his justice, he works to exercise mercy so that those banished from him through sin might not be forever sentenced. By those words, she's putting David as God's sovereign representative on the throne of Israel. She's putting David in mind to remember God's mercy, which David of all people could surely resonate with. So bottom line, here's what she's saying. Be merciful to the young man. Show the heart of God, knowing God in his own way and own time will render whatever justice is due. That, it seems to me, to be the logic here. And embedded in it, I think, is a reminder to all of us to remember that in the words of James, mercy triumphs over justice. Let us do what we're obliged to do in the way of promoting justice in imitation of God. But let us always be most eager, as circumstances allow. They don't always allow. But as circumstances allow, to show sinners the same mercy that God has shown to us. In the case of Cain, immediate justice by God's own standards would have been death. Yet, even in the case of Cain, God spared Cain, even as God set punishing constraints about him. Likewise, David deserved death. According to the law that God gave, yet God, who has the sovereign right to show compassion when and where he pleases, He showed mercy to David, even as he visited his sin with many grievous consequences. To show mercy, to be merciful, does not mean that we turn a blind eye to wrongdoing. It doesn't mean that we pretend it didn't happen. It doesn't mean that we are dismissive and say, I'm okay, you're okay, whatever. No, some justice, if not a full measure of justice, is necessary for the good of the offender and for social well-being. It's good, it's necessary, that society learn and individuals learn that sin does not pay. On the other hand, it's good that, like God, we show hearts that are merciful. We too are sinners and wrongdoers, and God has shown us mercy, and we should be merciful to the degree that we can be without compromising all principles of justice. Well, in verses 16 through 17, she's pushed her point to the limit, she knows. If she goes any further in that direction, she fears she'll give the whole game away between Joab and herself. Enough is enough. As wise as she was, she probably sees the wheel spinning in David's mind. The analogy has had its effect. In this section of the narrative, the wise woman of Tekoa, in a diversionary tactic, skillfully circles back to the issue she brought to the king in the first place, the matter of her fears regarding her son. Of course, the request is indirectly about Absalom, unless her own story also happened to be true and conveniently parallel, which I think is possible, but it's not the essence of the matter. David was a very wise and discerning man. In verse 18, his headlights are now on bright. The king, as we read between the lines, had been resistant to lifting Absalom's banishment because, as we've said several times, some in the family, like in the case of this woman and her son, wanted to avenge the blood of the murdered one. If David ignored their animus toward Absalom and brought Absalom back into the fold as heir, David was fearing severe political consequences. I suspect at this point in his reign, post-Bathsheba, and prophecies about the sword never departing from his house, David's sense of security on the throne was not as strong as before. I don't see how it could have been. Sin does that. Sin breeds insecurity. Perhaps he was uneasy about exercising his sovereign authority without a consensus in the palace family for fear all hell would break loose. Reading between the lines, we can safely infer, I think, that for some time Joab had been in David's ear about reconciling with Absalom and bringing him back into Jerusalem. That is because once David sniffed out a ruse in the woman's appeal, his first instinct was to suspect the hand of Joab behind this acting job. That suspicion would have been most unlikely unless Joab had been Absalom's court advocate for some time. Now David asked the woman of Tekoa to speak honestly to him. Tell me, is Joab behind all this? He asked pointedly. Immediately she acknowledged that Joab was the instigator of her performance, flatteringly telling the king that he was too sharp for anything to get past him. Yes, indeed. It was Joab who put all these words into the mouth of your maidservant. He did it just in order to change the appearance of things, help you to see it from a different angle. But we should have known that you would pick the ball out of the air. My lord is wise. You're like the wisdom of an angel or messenger of God, to know all that is in the earth. And she was wise indeed. By her words, she takes away any impression that they were playing him for a fool, but rather she credits David for seeing through this ruse as having an intelligence that's virtually angelic. That diffuses any offense David might have taken from this stratagem. A lesson here, however, is one that I mentioned earlier at the beginning of this story about human communication. The lesson is one that says a lot about the power of imaginative literature, art, and drama. These arts tend to sell their message obliquely and by indirection, and they catch the listener and the viewer off guard before they can put up their prejudices and too easily block out the message. So much of the scripture is narrative. I, for one, do not consider myself so skilled at that. I am more of what one might call, communicatively speaking, a blunt force object. But I mention that observation to any of you whom God may have so gifted, and I urge you to use that gift that we so often see employed in various means and modes in the scriptures. Prejudice is a powerful deterrent to seeing the truth. It can so easily divert logic. Artfulness in communication can sometimes slip the truth in the back door unawares and blow hindering biases out of the box. Well, David, verse 21, has gotten the point loud and clear. So on the spot, he makes an immediate decision to recall Absalom from exile. He doesn't have any trouble making decisions. He orders his champion Joab to see to it. Well, Joab's ecstatic. But we shall see that the beginning of a thing in life is not always the harbinger of its end. In fact, as the Proverbs tell us, one who loudly blesses his neighbor in the beginning is probably going to curse him in the end, just the way things tend to work. Joab fell on his face to the ground in customary Oriental reverence before his monarch, and he said, "Today your servant knows I have found favor in your sight, O my lord, the king." Translation, "I've been wondering where I stood with you since you haven't been hearing me lately, but now that the king has performed the request of his servant, I'm feeling good about your feelings toward me." By the way, note in all of these dialogues with the king, no matter how high or how low the rank of those who address the sovereign, all just define their status before him, and he's just a mere human potentate as your servant. Joab was David's field general. Still, he is just your servant. In the same way with the woman from Tekoa, she's just your servant. Well, how much more before Almighty God, we all, whoever we are, everybody before God is nothing more than your servant. That term levels us all. Somehow we have this habit among ourselves of making distinctions among ourselves, seeing ourselves bigger than we are, or in some cases less than we are. The truth is, in the eyes of our sovereign God, we are all his servants, and every one of us should make every conscious effort to mean that in spirit as well as in expression. If we think too big of ourselves, we are just servants. If we think too little of ourselves, we are God's servants, and that dignifies any life. Folks, we can and do easily get too full of ourselves. I used to see that when I was in seminary as a student. Used to see it a lot. I noticed a kind of evangelical aristocracy where some viewed themselves or viewed others as more than mere servants. It was kind of sickening, really. We're all just God's servants. Well, in verse 23, after that, Joab, his army chief of staff, immediately proceeds to Geshur, the native country of Absalom, where he's been hanging out with his own royal family there. And he ushers him back to Jerusalem. However, less than a royal welcome greeted the disappointed Absalom. As much as David wanted him home, David must have felt that the political feelings around the palace grounds were such that he could not afford politically to give Absalom the red carpet treatment. David decided that for appearance's sake, he had to keep Absalom more or less on ice. Not quite house arrest, but not free to run free in the royal residence either. Too much bad feeling there. So the king said to him, "Let him return to his house. But I don't want him to see my face." Absalom hadn't counted on that when he came back. So he returned to his house and did not see the king's face, but that's going to be a problem. We see how sin has turned relationship and politics into the royal family into a thicket of thorns. It's all coming true. Blood and sword in the midst of David's family. David can't win here. He's between a rock and a hard place. If, as Absalom returns, he gives him a returned hero's welcome, he's going to seriously alienate many in the royal family. If for their sake he gives the guilty Absalom the cold shoulder, which of the two he elects to do, he's setting the table for a big-time future conspiracy against his throne. Sin so complicates life. I've said it before, I say it again, it just ramifies. Sin is never self-contained. The sinner is never able to confine the damage to himself. It just reaches out like branches on a tree and touches so many others. Well, the narrator is building his story toward that evil event. Until now, the information we have about Absalom has been quite spare. But now the narrator begins to prepare us for the appeal of this son of David as a charismatic, king-like figure. He begins to explain how Absalom got such a hold on the imagination of so many in Israel when in David's later years he made his conspiratorial move. Verse 25, "In any public office or endeavor, though it is by no means a necessary credential, The truth is, we all know it, don't we? That handsome men and beautiful women, they always have a leg up. They may not end up on top, but they have a leg up. The game, in other words, is theirs to lose, which they often manage to do. But a prepossessing appearance, such as Absalom has, causes people to think one has it, whether or not one does. So it's an advantage that in popular affairs and public affairs cannot be discounted. And those who would compete against the rich and the handsome and the beautiful had better present an obvious advantage at it or be prepared to lose. That's not an axiom, but a tendency. There is such a thing as a kingly look, and that Absalom possessed in abundance. Too handsome really for his own good, which is often the case. We are told that in all Israel, there was no one as handsome as Absalom, and on top of that, so highly praised. He was the original matinee idol, for from the sole of his feet to the crown of his head, there was no defect in him. In short, male-wise, he was a perfect 10 physically. Spiritually, now that's another matter. However, people in general, being superficial judges of men or women, the public is inclined too often to measure people by their looks rather than by their character. Remember, Samuel exhibited that problem when he looked over David. And the Lord said, no, not that one and not this one. Don't look on appearance. I'm God. I judge another way. I look at the heart. If you're ever on a search committee for a church looking for a senior pastor, or you're looking for a president of a Christian college or some other Christian institution, whatever you do, don't allow yourself, as some do, to get seduced in your selection by some candidate who, like Absalom, just looks the part, but may not have the internals to match. In fact, often don't. Pretty boys typically have more swagger than substance. They are too often not good for much other than making little old ladies swoon. I've seen so many of the type. But like Absalom, by their good looks and their suave charm, they get a lot of undeserved mileage. In the end, Absalom was a big loser. But by that time, unfortunately, the damage was done. His magnificent head of hair, I guess he must have looked like Fabio. He only sheared like sheep once a year. In that culture, it lent an enhanced aura of manliness. And all that hair was startlingly thick and weighty, though the cited weight as we have it in our English text may reflect an underlying textual corruption, to which, as it is well known, the Hebrew numbering system lent itself. The narrator is telling us all this about the appeal of Absalom because it was part of the equation that allowed Absalom to get some traction under his eventual conspiracy and grow so bold as to launch it. The genealogical note about Absalom having 3 unnamed sons seems to tell us something else about Absalom being a chocolate Easter bunny, delightful on the outside, hollow at the core. Since his sons are never named, and he had set up a monument to preserve his name, the scholarly consensus is that he had no male heirs, and they must have died in infancy. The import of this information is this. The law declared, Deuteronomy 28:18, that disobedience to the Lord would bring about a curse from the Lord. It appears that warning played out in the case of Absalom, and the presumed death of his 3 infant sons was the mark of Cain on Absalom, however charismatic and handsome he might have been in the eyes of men. But those who will later follow him in his conspiracy appeared not to read the sign or test the substance, but they were seduced, as so many are, by all the flesh. So Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem and did not see the king's face. Well, friends, our time has expired. We'll pick up there the next time. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word, remember, is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us in this endeavor or want other information about this program or Jim Andrews, please visit our website at www.thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is jimandrews@thefinalwordradio.com. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this broadcast outreach.